Time to start saying bye-bye to the bailout.
The government cuts its stake in AIG.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, May 25th.
Coming up, we'll speak with a top Treasury official about one of the biggest bailouts from the financial crisis.
Also, YouTube tries to make itself more attractive to advertisers.
And it is International Geek Pride Day.
Indeed it is. I'll speak with an author who thinks the geeks will inherit the earth.
That's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
AIG was one of the biggest bailout recipients during the financial crisis. The company got into trouble insuring banks against losses on mortgage investments. And then, when all those investments went bad at the same time, AIG needed a $180 billion government bailout.
Well, yesterday, the Treasury Department sold off 200 million shares in AIG, cutting its stake in the company from 92% down to 77%. Timothy Massett is the Treasury Department's Acting Assistant Secretary for Financial Stability, and he's with us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how much did the government make on the sale of AIG?
We will get about $5.8 billion in proceeds. So this was a terrific step in recovering our investment in AIG.
But a lot of people say if you had sold shares earlier, you would have made more money.
Well, you know, it takes some time to get ready to do an offering like this. We have a lot of shares to sell, but we'll do it in an orderly manner so that we maximize value to the taxpayer.
You say it wasn't the government's aim, though, to make a profit off of AIG. Why not?
The government isn't a hedge fund. We're not trying to make investments to make a profit. But the fact is that we are hopeful that we can recover almost all of the money invested under the TARP program, and that's great news for the American taxpayer. The most important thing, of course, is that the actions taken prevented us from slipping into what could have been another Great Depression.
A lot of people looking back at the TARP say that the most dangerous thing about it was not that we might lose some money on it, but rather the precedent that it set for firms that take too much risk and think they're going to be bailed out by the government. What do you think of that?
Anytime the government provides assistance to a private company, there is moral hazard. And it's unfortunate that we didn't have the tools we needed to liquidate companies without having to do this. So I agree with that. The good news is that Congress has passed the Dodd-Frank legislation, which gives us a variety of new tools to liquidate companies whose failure would otherwise threaten the system. And it puts us in a position to avoid having to do this sort of thing again.
You think that Dodd-Frank solves the moral hazard problem?
Well, I think it gives us the tools to solve it, yes. But we have to implement those, and we have to use them aggressively and wisely.
Timothy Massett, Acting Assistant Secretary for Financial Stability at the Treasury Department. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now let's turn to our regular Wednesday guest, Richard DeKayser. He's an economist with the Parthenon Group, and he's with us from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what do you think? Do you agree that Dodd-Frank has sort of solved the moral hazard problem?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as saying it's solved it. It does help. This early intervention allowance by the Federal Reserve, which should prevent some real fiascos from happening. But so long as there are huge banks, for example, and the top five banks in this country have about 70% of all bank assets, that is, they're too big to fail. And as long as the government doesn't want to nationalize them, there will be a moral hazard. And it may be mitigated, but it's still out there.
Richard, all the rules from the Financial Regulation Reform Act, the Dodd-Frank Act, are being sort of figured out by the regulatory agencies right now. And the lobbyists are pouring in, trying to weaken them as much as they can. Do you think we'll end up with a good set of rules?
Well, I think we will. I think, well, relative to where we were, say, in 2008, I think things will be markedly improved. But, of course, lobbyists are working very hard to protect their interests, that is, shareholders of existing institutions. They don't want the government to impose a complete failure on them, so they will be watered down somewhat.
Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
In other news this morning, the Securities and Exchange Commission votes today on how corporate whistleblowers will be compensated for their deeds. The Dodd-Frank financial reform law created new rewards for corporate tipsters, but the law left it up to the SEC to decide exactly how to do that. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The biggest sticking point is whether tipsters have to report suspected wrongdoing to their bosses before or as they blow the whistle. Financial Services Roundtable chief lobbyist Scott Talbot says that would give companies a chance to solve problems themselves.
That the company is in the best position to take corrective action to end the activity that's in question.
Talbot says otherwise, whistleblowers could be tempted to make false claims to earn a big bounty. They stand to get 10 to 30% of any penalty or money the SEC recovers. The whistleblower rule is designed to prevent large-scale fraud like the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme. The National Whistleblowers Center says tipsters need a big financial incentive to come forward without telling their bosses. The center's executive director, Stephen Cohn, says they're afraid of losing their jobs.
If you force them to go within their company, many of them will remain silent.
The SEC may not get the last word. Its rule could be rewritten by Congress or challenged in court in Washington. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Television advertising in the United States is a $60 billion a year industry. Ad spending for online videos is just a tiny fraction of that. But this week, YouTube is ramping up its efforts to change the landscape. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
YouTube has built an enormous audience, serving up prank videos, animal bloopers, and laughing babies.
We're up to about 50 million impressions in the United States on the homepage.
And?
That's every day.
Kate Rose is a spokesperson for YouTube. Despite these big numbers, YouTube's ad sales are not so hot. Dave Hallerman is an analyst at eMarketer. He says big national brands don't want their ads running before a video of drunk teens dancing or babies barfing.
Actually, it's been almost embarrassing how few advertisers YouTube has gotten.
So YouTube created an ad plan it calls First Watch. It lets advertisers place the same ad on a bundle of different videos. No barfing babies or teens in the mix. Taken together, the videos could add up to a pretty big audience. How big? Think a commercial on Glee. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
A lot of businesses didn't buy as many pieces of equipment or heavy machinery. Orders for durable goods in April fell by the biggest amount in 6 months.
French Finance Minister Christine Lagarde said this morning she is officially throwing her hat into the ring to be the next head of the IMF. She has the support of some European countries, although there is a lot of groundswell among emerging economies that the next head of the IMF come from an emerging country.
Even Mexico has put up its own candidate.
That's right.
There you go. After causing airport delays in a bunch of German cities today, the Icelandic ash cloud is slowly moving away, allowing flights to resume. The volcano itself, Jeremy, has stopped erupting.
It has. Good thing, too, because, you know, some people might want to go to Europe sometime soon.
At some point, maybe. Yeah.
If you're looking for numbers, we've got them all at the numbers section, marketplace.org. Now to the Marketplace global perspective. Commodities regulators are suing two oil investors and their Norwegian-owned trading firms. The charges from the Commodity Futures Trading Commission actually date back to 2008, when international traders allegedly pocketed $50 million from Washington. Here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
U.S. regulators say two well-known traders, one in Oklahoma and one in Australia, bought up nearly 5 million gallons of oil to create an artificial shortage in early 2008. They then bet on oil prices to fall and sold their hoard at a big profit. The two traders had been able to do this twice before investigators stopped it. It's taken 3 years to put the case together. Julian Lee at the Center for Global Energy Studies says that's because of all the complicated auditing. Still, he says the possible fines in this case of $150 million should make speculators take notice.
It's the fact that cases are brought and that shows that people are alert to and watching what's going on in the market hopefully acts as a deterrent against using markets in ways for which they were not intended.
In the current tight oil markets, the Justice Department is investigating reports of market manipulation, but Lee thinks speculation is isolated. There aren't enough cases to drive global oil prices. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
In London today, the gardening industry is gathering for the world's most important annual flower event. But attendees better check the thorns on those roses twice, because It turns out there are counterfeit roses that have become a real problem. The BBC's Leslie Kerwin reports.
Like any good businessman, David Austin saw a gap in the market. 50 years ago, he combined the old English rose with modern roses to create a fuller, more fragrant variety. But to expand abroad, the company needs to place an enormous amount of trust in the growers they license in different countries across the globe. And the number one concern is that they don't illegally clone the company's unique roses. David Austin Jr. is now the managing director of David Austin Roses. He says they have to work hard to protect what is essentially their intellectual property.
We have our own licensing department with people whose full-time job is just inspecting records, inspecting fields all across the globe.
Austin says they've successfully prosecuted growers for counterfeiting their roses, but their biggest challenge is China. They know there are big opportunities there with the ever-growing middle class, but it's also the biggest producer of counterfeit goods, and they'd be taking a huge risk with their special brand. In London, I'm the BBC's Leslie Kerwin for Marketplace.
To Auckland, New Zealand now, where there appears to be a bug infestation problem. I don't know if you've heard about this, Steve, at the Sky City Casino.
Yeah.
Apparently, the management doesn't want to close the 24-hour casino for any length of time to deal with the problem because they don't want to lose any money.
Well, of course not.
So members of the staff have taken it upon themselves to get flea collars and wear flea collars around the casino so that they don't get bitten, which makes me feel a little better about my job where I don't have to wear any flea collars.
God.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/the Big Book.
Well, there's some new bipartisan legislation in the Senate that would limit the amount of money you can borrow from your 401k retirement plan. The senators who introduced it say there's a $6.6 trillion gap between what Americans have saved for retirement and what they'll need. For more, let's bring in LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, tell us about this new legislation in Washington.
Well, it's called the Savings Enhancement by Alleviating Leakage in 401k Savings Act.
Good
name.
Oh,
my goodness. Yes, indeed. And what it's intended to do is basically make your 401k more of a nest egg and less of a piggy bank. And it does that by reducing the number of loans you can take from your 401k at any one time and then making it less onerous to pay it back so you can stay in the savings game.
And how common is it for people to turn their 401ks into piggy banks?
Well, according to Aon Hewitt, which is an HR firm, in 2010, what we saw was about 28% of 401k participants having an outstanding loan. That's up from 22% in 2005. The average loan out was almost $8,000.
And I assume that you do not think it's a good idea in general to dip into a 401k.
You assume correctly, my friend. Now, look, a 401k is all about the future. It's all about investing in your retirement. The idea that you're going to borrow against it while it might have immediate gratification for you is only robbing your future. It's something you want to be very careful about.
But is there ever a situation when somebody comes to you and says, I'm going to dip into my 401k for this reason, and you say, that's a good idea?
Well, I wouldn't say that's a good idea, but I would say I understand it. For example, let's say you lose your job. You've got to make a mortgage payment. You've got to make a car payment. You've got no other available funds. Well, then, yes, there it is. And you're going to have to do what you got to do. But generally speaking, Americans are bad savers. We need to be better at that game. And we also need to plan more for our retirements because, let's face it, Social Security, pensions, things like that might not be there for you. It's all about what you put into it, and that's what a 401k is.
So you wouldn't say, go ahead and use some of your 401k to buy a house, for example?
Oh, I would not say that at all. I would say leave your 401k alone, and if anything, put more money into it.
LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeremy, happy International Geek Pride Day.
Happy International Geek Pride Day.
Did you know this?
Pride
did you know today? When you woke up this morning, did you? Okay, I just want, when you woke up last night, I should say.
Yeah, exactly.
We both came to work in the middle of the night. Of course, today is the day that we recognize the inner geekdom in all of us, right? Especially those who revel in introversion, knowledge of all things smarty pants, and the fact that high school wasn't all about the parties. You were probably a party
guy. No, I was not, actually. Really? I don't think I had my first beer until well into my high school years.
I don't know if I want to hear this or not. Alexandra Robbins writes about how geeks may have been tormented as youngsters, but when they grow up, they tend to have the last laugh and become very successful adults. Robbins wrote the book, The Geeks Shall Inherit the Earth, and she's with us now to talk about it. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How does one's social skills as a student have anything to do with their abilities later on in life as an adult?
My research shows that just because you're popular doesn't guarantee any sort of success or satisfaction in adulthood. In fact, it means just the opposite. I call it the quirk theory, and what it means is that many of the differences that cause students to be excluded in school are the same traits or skills that others will admire, value, or respect about that person in adulthood and outside of the school setting.
Do we have any examples, Alexandra, of who embodies this quirk theory?
One is J.K. Rowling, who has said that she was bullied in school because she was a daydreamer who had her nose in books. Well, she has gone on to create a world of outsiders.
Harry Potter, of course.
Yes. Another one is Lady Gaga. When she was in school, students called her a freak and made fun of her eccentricity. Well, now she's one of the most powerful celebrities in the world for precisely that reason.
Is the dynamic of popularity changing, do you think, in today's social media mecca? We have Facebook and Twitter. And all these different ways of kids getting in touch with one another, right?
Yes, definitely. High school today is not the high school of a generation ago. Facebook basically means that students feel like they have to be their own publicists, updating their statuses and changing their photos. It's really exhausting. It's as if the cafeteria follows you around 24/7, which is why I call Facebook the online cafeteria.
Were you popular in high school?
I wasn't a member of any one group, and I was also a dork, and still am.
you and I have a lot in common, Alexandra. Alexandra Robbins, the author of The Geeks Shall Inherit the Earth. Alexandra, thanks.
Thanks.
And finally, Jeremy, a judge has set a hearing for next month to determine whether the government will have to pay for a rare Ferrari wrecked while in police custody. This sports car was stolen from a Pennsylvania dealership in 2003. The FBI recovered it in Kentucky a few years later and kept the car as part of an investigation, a sting, if you will. Well, when an FBI agent and an assistant U.S. attorney were driving this Ferrari to a new location, the car mysteriously fishtailed on a curve, hit a tree, and was totaled. No, but there was just a few scratches and bumps on, you know, for these two guys. So no one was really seriously injured, thank goodness. The insurance company says the government owes them $750,000 for the car.
Wow.
The government says it's not going to pay. So the judge is going to hear this case starting next month. The men involved in the accident, they're not saying anything.
You know, it makes me think of those two guys that worked at the parking garage.
Oh, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That's right. That's right. Oh, we'll take care of your car.
Yeah, sure. We'll handle it. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Wednesday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.